When Lulu Wilson, a former Texas slave, talked about her mother, Chloe Ann, she remembered how her mother could cuss and fight. She said that every time Chloe Ann's master, Wash Hodges, tried to whip her, she inevitably beat him up, and he inevitably called for neighboring kinfolk to try to help him whip her again. They always refused to try to whip Chloe Ann. She had earned a reputation for once splitting the skull of a bloodhound that chased her during one of her escape attempts. She was captured, returned, whipped, and sold repeatedly, but her new owners always brought her back. Lulu Wilson did not remember much about her mother, but she did also remember that her mother prayed a lot. She remembered only one of her mother's prayers. It was one in which she promised God that if slavery ended before she died, she would quit cussing and fighting and raring.
Historian Stephanie Shaw. She's here to talk about women, resistance, and slavery in 19th century America. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with part two in a series of programs for Women's History Month 1996. Partial support for Soundings comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. From the vantage point of the 1990s, it's often easy to forget that the practice of slavery flourished in American society less than 150 years ago. As a reminder, historians draw upon a large and impressive body of research. Out of this have emerged studies of the slave personality, the slave family, and the ways in which slaves blended and used African and European cultures. But according to historian Stephanie Shaw, one of the aspects of slavery that's been neglected is the experience of females in bondage. For Women's History Month, Stephanie Shaw is here to talk about her new study of gender, resistance, and slavery in 19th century America. Stephanie Shaw teaches at Ohio State University, and during the current academic year is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center.
Well, Lulu Wilson was a woman who was a slave in Texas, and her mother, Chloe Ann, was a person who had a reputation for resisting her owner and overseer in every way she possibly could.
She beat him up, if I got this right?
She tried. She was she was probably fairly successful also at holding her own. Uh-huh. She regularly sought to beat him whenever he sought to beat her.
Now, is that because there was just one of her and one of him? There weren't other slaves involved, or he was timid? How do we account for this?
Well, in this case, she did, in fact, live in a situation where there were very few other slaves. Uh-huh. But I think it might say as much about her personality as it does about the environment itself. I mean, she just was a person who resisted these efforts to control her in certain ways.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk about the enormity of the institution of slavery, we can look at Chloe Ann and we can look at Lulu and we can find some solace, even some amusement in this, resistance and this confrontation that these two women put up in the face of being dominated, particularly by white men. The question becomes this. There's an enormous amount of literature about slavery. Mm-hmm. What is it that you are doing that puts a sort of new spin on this, particularly when we talk about the institution of slavery and the presence of women in that mm-hmm. system?
Well, I think, first of all, that we have had much research on slavery in general, but most of that material reads as if there was this generic slave. There was uh-huh. neither male nor female, young nor old, just some generic individual.
That's very insidious. I mean, here we're talking about objectifying humanity, mm-hmm. Draining people of their humanity.
Well, it happens all the time, I think, in publications, because partly because you're so limited in space. You're so limited in terms of how much you can say, how right. much you can write. And I think that much of the early literature on slavery was concerned with dealing with the institution as a whole. Mm-hmm. And not until that had been done did people start to pay particular attention to the specifics, to the individual people involved, or mm-hmm. to the social groups of people involved in the institution.
Well, it wouldn't be fair to say that you, Stephanie Shaw, have discovered the presence of women
no.
in the institution mm-hmm. of slavery, but you are making something of a unique or unusual argument here about mm-hmm. women and slavery.
Well, I think that what I'm doing is going to be slightly different from what people have done so far, because I am paying specific attention to the women, but I'm also trying to put these women in a social context mm-hmm. in order to see how they relate to all these other people involved, including men, slave owners, other enslaved men, mm-hmm. Their children, people who were around them but not related or connected to them in a direct way.
Tell me about some of these relationships, Stephanie. Slave women could be friends, lovers, mistresses, mm-hmm. mothers, supervisors. I mean, they really took on lots of different guises or positions vis-a-vis the institution mm-hmm. of slavery.
They really did. And I think that that's what will make, hopefully, what will make this study a different one. Even when you look at an individual person and her relationships to one person over time, they change tremendously over time. So that, for example, a slave woman and a slave child growing up together could have been best of friends, could have been playmates as children. But at some point in their lifetimes, in their life cycle, their relationship has to change. Uh-huh. Because the white children and the black children are being socialized right. to a set of roles that they're expected to live by as adults. So it's not unusual, and it doesn't seem unreasonable to me that these children might be playmates but have a very strained relationship, mm-hmm. for lack of a better word.
Sure. Now, part of the argument that white Southerners, for lack of a better sort of way to characterize the institution of slavery, part of the argument that white Southerners advanced to justify slavery was that it was patriarchal, mm-hmm. and they looked to the Bible for models. They said, basically, we're being beneficent. We are looking after black people as though they were children, adolescents. Is there anything at all to that argument? I mean, how, as a professional historian, do you come to that? Is that simply an anachronism that is back there in our history and you dismiss it? What do you think of it?
Well, I don't think you can dismiss it, because so many people believed that's what they were doing.
Right.
And so you have to deal with the evidence. You have to take the evidence seriously. They right. believed that's what they were doing. Some of them acted accordingly, you know, acted in those terms. So we have to pay close attention to that and reveal as much of that evidence as we can. But we have the advantage of hindsight.
Right.
And we can look at this same material and see both what they thought they were doing and attempted to do. Mm-hmm. And we can actually make some... We can give other meaning to it just by virtue of hindsight. I mean, for an example here, where these owners thought on one hand or believed on one hand that they were in fact bringing civilization to these people, that they were taking care of these people who were enslaved and that they wouldn't be able to survive, the slaves wouldn't be able to survive without them. Well, what we know is that whatever wealth, a good portion of the wealth the South enjoyed was generated by these people's labor.
Absolutely.
And also that the conditions under which they labored were so horrifying that simply in order to survive, these had to be very clever and careful individuals. They mm-hmm. knew what they were doing. They survived.
In their resistance, in the way they resisted.
In their resistance, and even when they weren't resisting. You
right.
know, for example, we have plantation records that reveal exactly what slave owners were giving to slaves to eat. You know, the rations that they got each week.
And we're not talking about haute cuisine here.
Oh, no. We're talking about mostly cornmeal
right.
and fatback meat.
Yeah.
And I can't imagine, anyway, an adult working the way some of these individuals worked and surviving on that diet. It's just too deficient in all sorts of ways. Well, what we know is that these people who were enslaved, male and female, supplemented their diet by fishing, by hunting, by planting their own gardens. And in fact, it's possible that they only survived because they were able to provide for themselves. So they weren't being provided for in the ways they weren't always being provided for, in the ways their owners thought, but their owners certainly believed that they were responsible for these individuals being alive.
So much for biblical patriarchy as a justification for slavery. Mm-hmm. Stephanie, your project, you're working specifically again on slavery and gender. What were some of the forms of resistance? How did women slaves stand up to the system and speak to it, confront it? As I understand it, it runs from the very subtle to the very explicit mm-hmm. and confrontational. Mm-hmm.
Well, they resisted, first of all, we could say they resisted in the same ways that men resisted. They did some of the same things that male slaves did. They didn't work as hard as they could have worked sometimes. They injured farm animals and damaged crops in order to affect the profits of their owners. They were violent resistors sometimes. They attacked their owners. But some of their forms of resistance were very specific to their being women and to their performing the kinds of work that women performed.
That is to say, being in the household and being
right.
domestic, that
right.
sort of thing?
Right, because women were often the domestic servants in the house, they had access to certain kinds of resistance that others didn't. Women who cooked, for example, could poison the food of their owners or mm. their children.
They could get their hands on knives.
Right.
Kitchen implements.
Right, they had access to weapons that other slaves might not have had access to just uh-huh. because of their work, and that work was defined partly by their being female. But their forms of resistance also relate to their being females in other ways. They were the reproducers of the labor force. They were reproducers of the slave population. And they could resist in that sense. They could resist in that context also by, for example, refusing to have children. Uh-huh. Sometimes that meant refusing to take up with a man that their owner had decided they should take up with.
Wasn't there a section in this material that you've given me to look at, Stephanie, where the white people say about the black slaves, they even have arcane methods of birth control. Mm-hmm. They know how to control their bodies in ways that, mm-hmm. that we, the whites, don't.
Well, I don't know that he meant that they didn't, but he certainly seemed surprised that mm-hmm. the slaves did know. But he believed, because it seemed that women within a particular family seemed not to have any children. Right. So he believed that within that family there was someone who possessed the knowledge, the medical knowledge, to prevent birth, right. whether birth control or whether some type of abortion procedure.
Now, when we speak of sexuality and gender and slavery, one of the popular myths, my impression, Stephanie, is that one of the popular myths is that black women were very much sexually demeaned mm-hmm. by their white owners. Will you speak to this issue and talk to our listeners about what the sort of facts and figures that you deal with as a historian, and either giving the lie or substantiating this popular notion of sexuality and slavery?
Well, one thing for certain is that a lot of these stereotypes arose out of efforts to justify other people's actions. It's clear that slave owners abused slave women sexually mm-hmm. in lots of ways. They were not only raped by these owners and overseers, but they were also regularly commanded to take up with, and I put that in quotes, other slave men solely for the purpose of increasing the wealth of the slave owner.
Right.
And these women were keenly aware of that exploitation. And so their forms of resistance sometimes reflected that knowledge. Sometimes, as I already said, they refused to take up with these men that they were being told they had to marry,
right.
even though marriage wasn't a legal institution under slavery. They were supposed to accept these men as their husbands and to have their children. When they were accused on occasion of having performed an abortion or having committed infanticide, some scholars have argued that we should think about whose children these were they were killing, you know, whose children they were not allowing to be born.
You make me think of Toni Morrison's novel, Beloved, these agonizing decisions that these women had to make.
Right, because they were certainly their children, these women's children, because they were born of their bodies, but they were also children of slavery. They were the children of this institution, whether they were fathered by the slave owner or not. Right. These children, in some way, were not entirely these women's children. And
I think about, there's a book called Celia, a Slave, by one of your colleagues, Melton McLaurin, who teaches at the University of North Carolina, how this is an account of one woman who just basically said, no, I'm not going to take this sexual abuse. Was that, to come back to that topic, was that typical, or is that very much the exception to women in slavery?
We almost can't know the extent to which that was typical. We can know where slave women, when slave women were accused of killing their owners. We have court records that that substantiate those claims, and we can follow these cases through those court records. But it's hard to know whether or not, except if it comes up in the trial, whether or not they were committing these acts because of a history of sexual abuse or any other kind of abuse, any other kind of direct physical abuse. The system itself was abusive and exploitive, but women certainly endured it. But at some point, some individuals decided not to endure it anymore. We don't have enough evidence about why all of them acted. But where murder was committed or alleged, we do have the public records. We have the court records. And we also have the treasury, often the Treasury Department's records, because if these women were found guilty of these crimes, they usually were either sold away or hanged. And in either of those cases, since the court sentenced them to that fate, the court had to reimburse the owners. So there are lots of ways to find in these records what happened. But we still don't know the truth of it. We don't know exactly what happened. We also do know, though, that there were lots of mulatto children. There were lots of children who clearly were not parented by two black parents. So we know that it happened. Now, whether, you know, the extent to which these were consensual relationships or forced rape, we don't know.
Stephanie Shaw, you are a historian from Ohio State University. We're talking about your scholarship with respect to female slave resistance and the antebellum South. Again, in this material that you gave me to prepare for our conversation, you note that one of the things that most scared, that was most fearful to the white slave owners, was the idea of conspiracy, the idea of an uprising. Now, the name Nat Turner comes to mind. Would you put the women slaves into that set of circumstances and talk to our listeners about it?
Yes, that's a very, very good example, actually, to start with, because Nat Turner certainly is the most feared. Even in history, he becomes this giant, this demon almost, and this larger-than-life person, and he certainly was in terms of his effort to organize and carry out this major conspiracy designed to overthrow this system. What I want people to think about is other ways in which conspiracies function. I think that one of the reasons that Nat Turner, for an example, is so well known is because what people pay attention to most of all are the consequences of an act. If lots of people get killed, or if there's potential for lots of people getting killed, there seems to be more attention and more legitimacy given to this incident.
Rather than what drove the incident, rather than what inspired the incident.
And also, in terms of conspiracy, though, I mean, the same kinds of things might motivate people to, you know, to damage tools that motivate somebody else to try to overthrow the system. Okay. But my point here is that conspiracies were at work even in these acts of resistance that didn't result in or never intended to result in the system being overthrown. There were still conspiracies. When people got together in the woods, in the hush arbors, they were called, you know, to pray or to sing or just to socialize. I mean, that was a conspiracy of sorts, because they were in defiance of the rules of the system. So I want people to just think about conspiracies in other ways. And if we do that, not only would more women be present in these reports of resistance, but also the full range of the ways in which men were involved in these conspiracies would be evident. Nat Turner and individuals who, Gabriel Denmark Vesey, individuals who led major revolts or planned them, probably were much more common than we know, but other kinds of conspiracies were even much more common than that.
Stephanie, what about belief and religion? Should we use a crude sort of label like slave religion, or what? How do you think about it?
Well, I think that religion, if you consider religion as a belief, a spiritual belief, or even knowledge in a higher power, we see it throughout slavery. And I think we see it in ways other than those people have written about. Usually when people talk about slavery and religion and resistance in the same breath, they see religion as being the motivator behind many of these great revolts. You know, slaves are reported as having seen visions in the skies. You know, angels talk to them. Mm-hmm. They got messages from God, that kind of thing happening. We also know that those people who've been accused of leading the great revolts or planning them, they also had some ties to religion, even to ministry. They were people who were considered slave preachers. Religion, however, in my mind, functions in other ways too, in resistance. In a very metaphysical kind of way, it's clear that these women are communicating with God all the time. They're talking to God, not just about their problems, but in an interesting way, like Lulu Wilson, they're negotiating. They're negotiating with God. They're saying, if you do this, then I'll do that. She says, if you're in slavery before I die, I'll quit cussing and fighting and raring.
Right.
And so she's using her understanding of religion and God's power and negotiating for an end to this institution, but I think in that she's also resisting slavery in a very interesting way. She's appealing to the person she sees not only as her real master, but as her owner's master as well.
So we're running the gamut here from the very particular, the idiosyncratic almost, the individual, on up to these large conceptual historical framing mm-hmm. devices mm-hmm. that you historians
right.
use when
right.
we speak of resistance.
Right. Yes. I don't talk how... I should add that I don't talk about religion itself. I mean, I think other people have, in a very effective way, worked on slave religion and the creation of a tradition.
Well, the contradiction of Christianity is,
right.
is one of the driving forces
right.
to sustain and justify slavery comes to mind.
Right. But I am more interested in how these individuals use religion, how
mm-hmm.
religion functions for them, rather than creating a religious ethic.
Stephanie, let me pitch you, speaking of the term metaphysical here, a very large question. In your studies of gender and slave resistance in the antebellum South, do you look at slavery as an economic system, or do you look on it as a system of just pure race hatred, white supremacy? How do we bring these two together or divide them when necessary to understand them?
I don't think you can divide them. Slavery was both an economic system and a social system. It was a system that generated great wealth, without any question. It was a labor system, so it was an economic system. But it was also a system that put people in social positions and political positions and sought to hold them there or keep them there. So I suspect that even had slavery not been profitable, it could have existed because of the social stratification it kept in place. And in fact, people have talked about why poor whites who didn't own slaves supported the system, why they supported the system. And, you know, some have argued that it was because they saw themselves as aspiring slaveholders. They could eventually hold slaves. They could eventually, if they were able to collect enough money, to gather enough money or get enough credit, they could eventually be slaveholders themselves. But even if they couldn't, what they could see in everyday life was that there was somebody underneath them.
Right.
There was somebody in this social and political system whose status was lower than their own.
Oh, that old idea of hierarchy.
Yeah.
Where would you historians be without that? Here's a footnote to our conversation, Stephanie Shaw. How do you want women, how do you want people, men and women, to think about this issue of slave resistance and gender in the antebellum South? I mean, here we live in our our mass America, mass society. We have our racial problems, to be sure. But when we speak of this awful, degrading enormity of slavery, it does in fact seem distant from us in time and space. And yet, for you historians, it's very much a sort of present issue. How should we think about it today?
I suppose what I want to do in my work, the contribution that I want to make, is to have people look at these women and others who were enslaved as individuals, as people who possessed a humanity and who possessed some dignity and who had ideas about how they, even as slaves, should live their lives. And my favorite example is from a slave narrative that was taken in Alabama in the 1930s. This woman named Sarah Pugh reported to her interviewer, "I was born a slave, but I ain't never been a slave." And it is the most powerful thing I think I've ever read that was attributed to a woman who was enslaved. It seems to me that she is saying something about her humanity. She's saying something about the fact that this institution never dehumanized her. She was a worker, and she goes on to say she was a worker and not a slave. And I think that if we recognize the humanity of these people, we can have a greater potential for understanding the full range of their lives. And I think that the resistance that I'm looking at, in fact, runs that range. And that's the contribution I want to make.
Stephanie Shaw teaches at Ohio State University. She's at work on a new study about women, resistance, and slavery in 19th century America. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond with the second segment in a series of programs for Women's History Month 1996. Stephanie Shaw's most recent book is entitled What a Woman Ought to Be and to Do, a study of black professional women workers during the Jim Crow era. What a Woman Ought to Be and to Do was published last month by the University of Chicago Press. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guest this week was historian Stephanie Shaw. Audio tapes of this discussion are available for $10 postpaid. Our address is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. When you write, please ask for program number 806. That's $10, program number 806. Our address again is Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code again, 27709. Next week on Soundings, Brave New Worlds. Join me for the first of two discussions about the ethics of biotechnology and gene transplants. Over the next 2 weeks, I'll talk with experts from the Humane Society of the United States, Duke University Medical Center, and novelist Alan Gerganus about the perils and rewards of medical practice involving transgenic animals. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.